The hamburger used to be the symbol and cornerstone of fast food and all the negative associations that come with it. But as the demand for fresh, organic, locally sourced food rose, so did the lowly hamburger. For this week's Please Explain, we're talking all about the history and the future of the hamburger with Benjamin Wallace, whose article, The Play-Doh of Meats, is the cover story of the June 1st issue of New York Magazine, and Pat LaFrieda, whose meat purveyors have changed the way many New Yorkers eat burgers. Later on in the show, we will speak with Adam Kay, the Vice President of Culinary Affairs at Blue Hill, about reinventing the veggie burger. But for the moment, Ben and Pat, welcome to our show.
Thanks.
You hear me, Pat?
I'm on.
Okay, great. Let's
How
begin
are you,
with
gentlemen?
Let's begin with Ben. Where did the hamburger originally come from? Do we know?
There's some debate about that, but some of the claimants are the Tatars in ancient Mongolia, you know, rode the steppe with raw chopped mutton under their saddles as a snack.
Is that why we call it beef tartare?
Exactly, steak tartare. That migrated at some point to Europe, and in Hamburg, it was called Hamburg steak. Hamburg, people from Europe were immigrating to the U.S. through Hamburg, so in New York, it became known as the hamburger, but it really didn't become what we know as the hamburger, a sandwich between bread, until later on at Louis' Lunch in New Haven.
Where does Salisbury steak fit into this? Because it's kind of like a hamburger as well.
You're right, and I do not know.
So it came here with the German immigrants, it was sold here in New York first?
It appears on a 19th century Delmonico's menu, so it was available there. But as a sandwich, it did not. It appeared in New Haven first.
Now, Delmonico's was an upscale restaurant at the time, so was it seen as an upscale dish?
You know, I actually don't know that.
Didn't White Castle play an important role in the history of the
yes.
burger?
White Castle is considered by hamburger historians, there are such people, to have created the hamburger as we know it, because they introduced a standardized, enriched white bun.
Mm. And that weird square burger.
And the weird square burger, which was more efficient because you could fit them more of them on the flat top.
Pat, when did your family start its company?
In the early 1900s, actually, I mean, first on record, we were at 1922. We started in New York City.
Mm-hmm. And were you selling hamburger meat from the start?
My grandfather has been doing his own version of chopped beef since then. He's always been, you know, doing what we do now, but he was doing it much more simple. He was doing a much more smaller, you know, batch of it. But yeah, he always had that same idea. I just want to keep it simple and keep it good.
Of course, for many people, hamburger meat simply meant going to the butcher and picking out a piece of beef and then having it ground in front of their eyes. When did we start having it ground before it ever reached the butcher?
You know, the misconception with burgers was correct. It was always something that either people used to settle for in a restaurant or they couldn't decide, so they'd say, hey, I'm going to have a hamburger, or I'll have a burger, I'll keep it simple. Or when you used to go to the butcher would take what he would call ground round or ground chuck or anything that he would have left over or he couldn't sell the previous day, or perhaps even trimmings, things that, you know, weren't selling, and he would make into a final byproduct, which he could then sell. And naturally, as you know, when you're using inconsistent items, you're going to come up with an inconsistent product. And that's something that we never wanted to do. We wanted to start with a good product and finish with a good product.
Is it important to have a lot of fat in the meat?
It's a recipe like anything else, and it has to be done, you know, to a strict guideline of how you use equal portions. And that's, you know, that's what we do. We don't change our recipes or the way we do things, and we don't, you know, we don't base them on cost. We don't base them on market. Like, we use a lot of brisket in a lot of our recipes. So if briskets go up because of it's St. Patty's Day or because of the Jewish holidays, you know, we're not going to stop using brisket. We're not going to go to a cheaper cutter. We're not going to improvise. We don't take the shortcuts like that.
We're talking with meat purveyor Pat LaFrieda and with Benjamin Wallace, the author of The Play-Doh of Meats, which is in the June 1st issue of New York Magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Ben, you start your article with a group you call the Burgerati. Who are they?
Yes. Well, that's a name they gave themselves. They're a Sub Rosa group of hardcore burger devotees.
Who also call themselves burger nerds.
Who call themselves burger nerds, call themselves burger aficionados. And each of them has a particular strong connection to burgers. One of them created an app that allows you to find a good burger wherever you are in the U.S. and even the world, and then to rate that burger. Some of them come from a company called Burger Lift, which makes individual trivets for your hamburger. It's a low, round, kind of grated pedestal you pull out of your pocket, put on the table, and then they put the burger down on top of it, and it allows the juices to drain off without soaking your bun.
So they have different burger eating habits than the rest of us?
They do. They eat more burgers than the rest of us.
Why do so many chefs and burger aficionados love Martin's potato rolls, those soft, pucky things you get in the supermarket?
I think it has something to do with the squishiness of it, and then also some people like it as a little bit of sweetness. That's controversial, though. There are some people who consider it to be an adulteration because of that sweetness.
By the way, we invite our audience to join this conversation. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Pat, where do you get your beef from?
We get it from pretty much, you know, the standard states in the Midwest, Leonard. We use pretty much the, you know, I was listening to you talk about tequila, and, you know, it can't be called tequila if it doesn't come from Mexico, or champagne if not from the Champagne region. It's true the same about beef. The best beef in the world comes out of the Corn Belt region of the United States, out of the Midwest, from Kansas, you know, Omaha, Nebraska, you know, in that area of the world. And, you know, no one, there's a lot of speculation and argument, but nobody does beef like the United States, because we have the room, we have the corn to do it, we have the grains, you know, and we do it really well. And whether you're doing an all-natural program, an organic program, you know, or just a regular, you know, premium program, the Midwest is the place to do it because of the area and the room. And I'd say 95% of our beef comes out of the Midwest region or the Corn Belt states.
Well, does some people argue that grass-fed beef tastes better and is healthier?
Well, that's the age-old argument of taste great, less filling. I mean, all animals eat grass for a certain portion of their life. For the first 6 months of the animal's life, they're on the mother, and then they wean off the mother, and then they go on to grass for a certain amount of time. And then what most people don't realize is that, you know, depending on, you know, the farm or wherever they're finishing the animal is usually only kept on grains and flaked corn or, you know, whatever the feed is for 2 to 3 months, sometimes 4 months, because that's where it gets expensive. So proportionally, every animal is grass-fed. It doesn't eat corn its whole life. It doesn't stay on the mother for it its whole life. There are animals that are 100% grass-fed, so from 6 months on the mother to grass and, you know, hay and everything like that. But that is a different flavor. It's a different flavor profile, and to each his own. Some people like that, and some people don't.
Haven't beef prices been rising over the years?
The last 3 years, they've been really, really out of sight. I mean, so many things that affected them, you know, from a few years back with the drought and, you know, the corn prices and oil, and everything seems to have an effect. And the growers, you know, the farmers who are raising the animals, they call them the cow and calf operations, who start off the animal. People don't realize that it takes about 2 years for an animal from birth to harvest. And what happens is it's a 2-year cycle. So if we run short, it's not like we can just, you know, drop water on powder and make instant animals. We can't. We have to wait. And the demand never, ever subsides unless the pricing gets out of control. So pricing, in effect, is like a clutch for, you know, the country and the growers. They raise the prices as the demand gets too high, and then that stops a lot of the people and moves them on to poultry and other proteins. So, yeah, beef has been rising for the last 2 to 3 years, and in the last year since 2015, it's finally started to level off and, you know, get a little bit more of a correction.
Have restaurants been embracing burgers because they're a cheaper alternative to other meat dishes that might use more expensive cuts?
Burgers have always been a viable option when it comes to cost. You know, burgers are a feel-good food. You know, when a lot of the country went through times, you know, not so long ago when we had a recession and everything, people were eating a lot more burgers. It was cheap. It was a more inexpensive option. A lot more restaurants put a burger on the menu, especially during lunch. Is it going to replace the high-end steaks, the lamb racks, the veal chops, things like that at night? No. New York City is a very eclectic town. It's got New Yorkers. It's got people from all over the world. It's got tourists. There are people who are coming to New York, and they want to eat that steak. They want to eat red meat. They want to try the burgers as well, because New York is now the burger town. But, I mean, one won't suffice the other. It will subsidize it a little bit at times.
Ben, sales at McDonald's dropped for the first time in a decade. Is that a reflection of changing taste for burgers?
I think it's a indication of changing tastes in food in general. I mean, I think people are a little disillusioned with the sort of mass fast food corporations, including McDonald's. There was a survey by Consumer Reports last year. McDonald's hamburger came in 21st out of 21 different fast food burgers. So people
below Burger King and Wendy's even?
Below Burger King and Wendy's even. So at the same time, you have the growth of what's called the better burger category, which includes here in New York, most famously Shake Shack, but it also includes chains like BurgerFi and Smash Burger and Umami Burger. Five Guys is the biggest of them, or the fastest growing of them. And so people are realizing there's a better alternative.
And a listener wonders about the In-N-Out Burger, which is not available here, but which people on the West Coast swear by.
In-N-Out
Burger. Do they use different? Do all of the better ones use better beef?
One thing is they use fresh beef. I mean, McDonald's uses frozen beef. In-N-Out Burger is sort of the original better burger restaurant. I think it's been around since the 50s, but it's never really changed what it does. And people more and more are yearning for that sort of nostalgic In-N-Out style burger.
Pat, how did your company get involved with Shake Shack?
God, it's been probably 10, 11 years now. Danny Meyer had a concept with a few of his key people and a chef. They wanted to do a little hamburger stand in the park in Madison Square Park over there, and they approached us, me and my cousin Mark. And at the time, you know, we were looking back and forth, and we didn't really understand. And it was, you know, just at the start when burgers started to get a little bit more popular in New York City, and they couldn't have timed it more right. They came to us and they said, you know, give us a great blend of a burger, give us something that we could use. And at the time, I came up with their blend, which now became the Shake Shack blend, which is now proprietary and, you know, exclusive to them only.
And how is it different from the blend that you give to Minetta Tavern?
Different black and white. Minetta Tavern uses a aged blend, which we use actually aged cuts of meat, like prime rib inside, like a ribeye, and we use chuck and brisket, whereas Shake Shack is a sweeter blend of meat. It's a brisket, and it's chuck, and Shake Shack also is one of the few, you know, burger groups that we talk about. I hate using the word chain. That is an all-natural product. It's an Angus program, and it's an ABF program, so it's all-natural, antibiotic-free, hormone-free.
Do you eat burgers when you go out to a restaurant?
Unfortunately, I still do. Myself, my cousin.
You say unfortunately?
You know, the whole family does. Yeah, because it's like, at this point in my life, it's like, I'm trying always to, you know, I want to keep myself in shape, and my cousin does as well. And, you know, burgers are good, and they're great, and they taste good and everything. But unfortunately, the French fries come along with them. The bun comes along with them. The sauce comes along with them. And then what else are you eating? Are you having a beer with it? And the whole package together, it's like, you know, usually that slope that goes on. It's like, wow, this is great. Now I want this. Now I want that. Now I want this. So I try to limit it. I try to, you know, eat a more balanced diet like everyone does. But I find New Yorkers in general and people around the country, like you were saying about McDonald's, if they're going to have a burger and they're going to, you know, do those calories and they want to eat like that, they're going to do it right. You know, it's not, they don't want to do it, you know, where it's like a secondary program. They want to have a good burger.
We're talking about burgers on today's Please Explain with Pat LaFrieda, who supplies meat to some of the more upscale burger suppliers these days. Benjamin Wallace, who wrote an article called The Play-Doh of Meats, about all different kinds of burgers for the June 1st issue of New York Magazine. Excuse me, we're going to take a little break now. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Adam Kay, Vice President of Culinary Affairs at Blue Hill, and we'll be talking about the veggie burger that they developed as part of their Wasted program. Stay with us for more. We'll be talking about burgers burgers made out of meat, although beef. Later we'll start talking about other things because Mike from Manhattan, a chef, called in to say he's mixing beef with pork and veal as a new strategy. But right now we are joined by Adam Kay, the Vice President of Culinary Affairs at Blue Hill, who developed an incredible veggie burger. Adam, when did you start thinking about doing that?
Leonard, when we were brainstorming the menu for our Wasted program at the pop-up that we ran at Blue Hill in the city in March, you know, it was very much an ingredient-driven menu, a waste ingredient-driven menu. And we stumbled across a literally unlimited supply of vegetable pulp from a cold-pressed juice facility in Long Island City that was supplying a few juice bars around the city. And we never really set out to do a veggie burger, but we came to it, I guess, just from experimenting with beet pulp and carrot pulp, and we had some different ideas we were touring around with, and thought it would be fun to put a burger on the menu. Meat was already pretty well represented in other parts of the menu, and we started working with the idea of the veg pulp burger. It took us a while to get there, though.
How much trial and error does that involve? Developing
a
recipe?
I mean, a lot. I think just making a veggie burger to begin with is not necessarily the easiest thing, I think, sort of evidenced by a lot of the veggie burgers that are out there.
Was your goal to make it taste like beef?
No, I really wasn't. I mean, our goal was to figure out what to do with vegetable pulp. And it took a lot of addition and subtraction, and we were working primarily with beet and carrot pulp, some green pulp as well, celery. And on their own, it's basically vegetable fiber. It brings a lot of color. It has some good flavor, but it's just fibrous material. So it needed a lot added to it. And we added a lot, we took away a lot, and we kept tinkering. And ultimately, it actually, the effect that it had in terms of appearance, certainly, you know, it looked a lot like a beef burger. We actually had a client at Wasted who was a vegetarian, and after taking a bite, pushed it away and complained to the manager that she had ordered a veggie burger, and the manager was a vegetarian herself, had to sort of convince her that this truly was, that there was no meat in this. But there was some sort of, I don't know, voodoo alchemy that was going on with this the ingredients that actually ended up tasting a lot like a beef burger.
Did you cook the burger the same way you would have if it was made of beef?
Yeah, we grilled it. We just grilled it on a really hot cast iron grill. And I think that's where there was some chemistry going on there in terms of charring the outside and sort of caramelizing the sugars in the vegetables. And then topping it with some good cheese to melt that we ended up with something that really had a kind of a meaty flavor and somewhat of a meaty consistency. But I think a trap that people fall into with veggie burgers, they try too hard to make it seem like beef or meat. And again, we were just trying to make something delicious, and it seemed to work out pretty well.
And will it have a life beyond the pop-up?
Yeah, I mean, it already has. It's continued in some form or another in both Blue Hill New York's menu and up at Blue Hill at Stone Barns. We're using it, if not in the form of a burger, then we're taking that mix and we're using it in other forms. Just this past week, there were two non-Blue Hill events that ran the burger. Actually, Shake Shack in Madison Square Park this past Friday ran the Wasted Veggie Burger as a one-day special. Sweet Green, the organic salad chain, has a festival, a music and food festival in D.C. called the Sweet Life Festival this past weekend as well, and for 2 days they ran the Wasted Burger down there as well. So, it has a life, and we're sort of toying with how that life will continue beyond that.
Pat, are you afraid of the competition?
Are we afraid of the competition?
No, not at all.
Now, one of the other things, Adam, is you also did a special kind of bun for this burger.
Yeah, that was really, I think, sort of critical to the whole, the success of this. So we worked with Balthazar Bakery, with Paul Oland, who's just, this incredible baker and one of the founding bakers at Balthazar. And she made what she called this repurposed bread bun, which was really in the spirit of Wasted, and took old rye bread and stale rye bread and added water to that to sort of make a mash that she then added to a new bread dough and made hamburger buns. It's actually an old tradition of using, old bakery tradition of using old bread and reconstituting it into a new dough.
And it turned out to be the best hamburger bun I've ever had.
Well, that's very kind of you. I'll make sure Paula knows that. it worked really well, and she made this wonderful sort of like crumble, these bread crumbs, also out of old stale bread, so it had like this nice crunch to the top of the bun as well. It worked really nicely with the veg pulp patty as well.
We want to take a call now from Keith from Ridgewood, New Jersey. Hi, Keith.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
Okay. I had the pleasure of my first wild boar burger last night. Unbelievable. It was, they came, fairly pricey, but There were three in a frozen package. I just had two. And since they were thin, I cooked them in a hot pan with added some bacon, actually, on top of it. I don't know if that's adulteration, but...
bacon is never adulteration.
It was fabulous. Anyway, there's a lot of bacon fat left over, pre-cooked the bacon, and just pretty much seared the burgers in the pan, and then finished them on the grill, a wood grill, and so I could keep it medium rare. And, oh, my God, it was just fabulous. And there was a sufficient amount of fat in it, so it was nice and juicy and really a wonderful flavor.
Ben, have you been following the wild boar burger trend?
It sounds delicious. Mm-hmm. I mean, the purists
Can
I spoke to would not the purists I spoke to would not consider that a burger because it's not beef, but I'm not a purist, so.
Well, what about the adding other things? Some people add veal. Well, veal, of course, also comes from a cow, but some people will do a mix of veal and pork and beef. Is that not a pure burger? Right.
I mean, not as far as the purists are concerned, but I think most people, myself included, would be happy to eat it.
Were purists upset when Daniel Ballou came up with his DB burger?
I wouldn't say they were upset because it's such an amazing and delicious burger. I mean, one critique that I've heard of that burger is that its architecture is flawed because there's a piece of foie gras in the middle and it's impossible, and it's cut in half and served cut in half. And so when you take a bite, the foie gras can pop out. But, you know, that's sort of a nitpick, and I think even the purists that I spoke to enjoy it.
And I am assuming that's also been imitated.
The Ballou burger. It's more than imitated. It's been sort of superficially copied and competed with to the point where after Daniel Ballou introduced that burger in 2000 or 2001, a bunch of other restaurants started coming up with even more expensive burgers, because I think his was $28 initially. Suddenly you had the Homestead Steakhouse offering, I think, an $81 burger. Then there was a place, Serendipity 3, that had a $295 burger. And they kept adding more and more absurd ingredients, you know, leading to the addition of gold leaf and even a diamond-studded toothpick.
Pat, many of the restaurants have been advertising that they only use meat from humanely raised cattle. Is there a difference in quality between the what they're calling humanely raised cattle? First of all, humanely raised, I guess, means that they're free range?
Humanely raised starts at birth and it carries, you know, over all the way to harvest, depending on how the animal is raised, how it's treated, how it's finally, you know, harvested and processed. And yes, there is a difference. I mean, you can see it in the animal, you can see it in the meat, you can see it's a less stressed animal, it's a less stressed piece of meat, so the muscle is not going to be as tough. And it's going to be more tender, it's going to be more viable, it's going to be a better option. And people feel better about eating it as well.
And you only use muscle meats, muscle cuts?
We only use whole muscles when we do any of our burgers or our recipes. You know, there's multiple reasons for that, but, I mean, the largest one would be quality, consistency in flavor, consistency in recipe, safety for E. coli and things like that. We don't ever put trimmings. You know, we don't use any of that frozen mechanically deboned beef. We don't use anything imported. We use only domestic beef. We're pretty strict with our guidelines on how we do things.
Adam, Blue Hill just was named one of the 50 best restaurants in the world. Where do you go to get your beef, or is that a trade secret?
Trade secret. We actually don't use a lot of beef on our menu, just for the, I mean, there's a variety of reasons for that. There's not a lot of beef being produced at Stone Barns, primarily.
You have cows on the farm, but...
Yeah, not on Stone Barns, actually, on a neighboring farm, and that's a breeding stock. We do get beef from Blue Hill Farm up in the Berkshires, up in Weston, Mass. We work with Hardwick Beef, which is a cooperative of all grass beef farmers. We have some standing orders with them at certain points of the year. You know, we get a lot of veal. That's sort of where, in terms of meat from cows, we get a lot of veal from Blue Hill Farm, which is something that we're very excited to showcase at certain times of the year. But generally, there's not a huge amount of beef on our menus.
John from New Canaan, Connecticut asks, is Wasted going to come back? Is Blue Hill going to publish the recipes anywhere?
Is Wasted going to come back? Well, we're going to see. It may come back in some form or another. I think maybe part of the charm of Wasted and the success was that it was a pop-up for a few weeks. And I don't know. I guess maybe we should crowdsource that the answer to that question. And the recipes, as of now, we're not going to do a Wasted cookbook just yet. But
well, there's plenty of Wasted food that you can draw from.
Absolutely. And the recipes continue, you know, in the kitchen at both restaurants in some form or another. At least the ethos does. And sort of looking to, you know, and if we did have to redo it, I don't think we would necessarily run it with the same menu either. So we could have some fun and look for new supplies of Waste.
Ben, you write about two schools of thought in the hamburger world, essentialists and circumstantialists. How do they see the evolution of the burger differently?
So the dispute is basically, you know, is there something intrinsic about the hamburger that is, you know, made it sort of the iconic American sandwich, or did it become the iconic American sandwich because of some sort of historical accident? And so the essentialists believe that there are things such as the hamburger's shape, which gives it a lot of surface area relative to its volume. So that's more area for the kind of browning Maillard flavors relative to the juicy interior. There's the size of it. It's portable. You can hold it in your hand even with the other hand on the wheel. And some, including Pat, I think, would argue that beef itself is the most subtly flavored meat protein. The circumstantialists, on the other hand, just think that, you know, it could have been the hot dog, but the burger happened to be the sandwich that White Castle and McDonald's focused on, and they popularized it.
For years, it was impossible to get a decent burger in Europe because they adulterated too much. They put breadcrumbs and other things in it.
I actually was not aware of that.
I remember the Wimpy Burger in England. It was a burger that no American would ever want to eat. Adam, somebody wants to know if you can make a veggie burger at home. One of our listeners. Is that possible, or would I have to go to that place, that juicing place that you drew from?
To make a veg pulp burger at home? Or just a, you don't need to go. I mean, you could, you know, if you're juicing at home, you could certainly save all that pulp and bind it with some other ingredients, some kind of a legume and some grain. But no, you don't need to find a commercial supplier unless you want to make, you know, any large quantities. But I do know a lot of people juice at home, and you know, there's certainly value in that pulp that would probably get thrown away or composted. But again, it's not just a matter of taking that pulp and forming it into a burger-shaped patty and cooking it, because that's probably not going to work.
Ben,
you certainly could try.
Ben, the reason I asked you about England was you also profile Heston Blumenthal in your article, A British Chef. And is he making burgers?
Well, so he embarked on a project a few years ago to make sort of perfect versions of common foods, including pizza and including the hamburger. And he had an experimental kitchen where they spent 6 months trying to perfect the hamburger, and they went to extraordinary lengths to do it. They were consulting with an oral physiologist who advised them on jaw mechanics and said, you know, the patty and bun together should not be more than two fingers thick. It would otherwise just be too uncomfortable to eat. They also advised them to, when they ground the meat, align all of the protein strands.
I have to leave it there, unfortunately. We've run out of time. My great thanks to Benjamin Wallace. His article, Play-Doh of Meats, is in the New Yorker, in New York Magazine. Pat LaFrieda, the great purveyor. Adam Kay, Vice President of Culinary Affairs at Blue Hill.